When are people going to see that nothing ain't never going to change unless somebody finally makes up its mind to stand up and fight? Damn.
Netroots Radio presents Hopping Mad with Will McLeod and Arliss Bunny. Now, here's Will and Arliss.
Welcome to Hopping Mad. I'm Will McLeod.
And I'm Arliss Bunny.
Today, I'll be talking about Trump's love of dictators and his cozy relationship with Vladimir Putin.
And I'll be talking about Audit the Fed.
But first, we have a few stories. I want to talk a little bit more about the Brexit fallout. It's been reported in the Financial Times and in a number of car magazines that British auto manufacturing is in trouble. Japanese companies have opened up plants there, and General Motors has bought out the traditional UK firm Vauxhall. Now, what needs to be understood is that Vauxhall has already been kind of in trouble. Since 2012, the Ellesmere Port plant has been under the threat of closure because the production of vehicles isn't sustainable if it's just in the UK market. What the GM UK plants do is they produce Vauxhall left-wheel drive vehicles for the market in the UK, and then produce a ton of right-wheel drive Opel vehicles for the European market. Now that the UK is set to leave the common market and to be denied tariff-free access to the common market, because, again, we talked about this last week, there are the four freedoms you have to accept, which includes the free movement of labor. And if you aren't willing to accept that, then you're not going to have access to the common market. The market simply doesn't work. But since they don't have that access, it's going to be very difficult for those plants and the Japanese plants to continue to manufacture vehicles that are then sold to the rest of the EU. What's ironic has been the rise in anti-Polish sentiment in the UK. Poles are seen in the same racist light in the UK that Mexicans are seen in some segments of the United States. They're accused of taking people's jobs, and they're often racially abused. And so what's very ironic about that is that GM has made some signals that they may be moving their UK production from Ellesmere Port to their factory in Poland. So congratulations, UK. You have kicked out the Poles, and they're taking the factories with them. The reason that's likely to happen is for two reasons. Number one, exporting to the EU is already difficult if you don't have a company subsidiary within the EU. That puts all these tariffs in your way, and there are all these regulations you have to follow, and it's a massive headache. So people opened up a lot of firms in the UK specifically to get access to the common market. This is true of everything from banking to auto manufacturers to creative firms even. And so that's the main blow right there. But there's a double blow. If you look at the figures of what's called the producer price index, and what the producer price index is a system that represents the costs for a manufacturer. So if you're a manufacturer, PPI measures what it costs you to buy fuel and energy and paint and widgets and whatever it is you need to make things in your factory. PPI measures that. PPI in the UK right now is skyrocketing because the fact that they're leaving the common market means that everything that is going to be bought in the British marketplace is going to be more expensive. So that means that not only will they face high tariffs getting things into the EU, not only will they face regulatory issues, not only will they face all of those problems, but it's also going to cost much more to manufacture all of those goods because of the loss of access to things made in Europe that they had been purchasing in order to make cars.
Will, why didn't anybody tell this to the people who were voting for Brexit before they voted for Brexit?
They did tell them. They told them over and over and over again. They were told. They were warned by the mayor of Liverpool, who said the Ellesmere port is going to close. that plant is going to close, and he's in a position to know, and everybody called him a liar. And now that Brexit has happened, GM hasn't announced a plant closure, but they've refused to rule it out, saying simply that the UK must maintain its membership of the common market. And they also have made a lot of moves in the background that lead a number of auto magazines to suggest that they are absolutely stepping up a move of the production from Vauxhall plants to their Opel plants in Poland. People were warned, but they decided they'd had enough of experts and didn't want to listen to people who knew what they were talking about and voted for Brexit anyway. And that's what's so ridiculous about this, is that this is shooting yourself in the face despite your nose. And it's a disaster.
Well, and it's enormously frustrating because it didn't only happen there. It, of course, happens here all the time as well, which is just, it's the kind of thing that makes me, I think, maybe the craziest. When we know what we're doing wrong, and we do it anyway.
People were told, that voting for Brexit would mean the closure of plants and the moving of business. And what's so amazing is that the Brexiteers you'll run into on Twitter and elsewhere are still refusing to believe the facts. I'm really starting to wonder that if the plants actually do close when businesses finally move to the mainland or to Ireland or hopefully to an independent Scotland, if the Brexiteers will be standing around, you know, covering their eyes and pretending that all the plants are still open.
It's the la 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 form of economics.
At what point will these folks accept reality? I just don't know. And again, the thing that's so worrying about that Ellesmere Port plant for the people of Liverpool is that it has been on the chopping block since 2012. The only reason it's still open is because the union that works at the plant was willing to accept some pretty brutal terms, which involved no pay rises. That's the only way they were able to keep the plant open at all, was by having massive concessions both from Liverpool and from the workers at that plant.
And economic trouble in Liverpool goes way back. Liverpool has been struggling for a very, very long time.
The fact that it was going to be a struggle for Ellesmere Port plant to stay open was always going to be the case. With this shock, I'm really not sure how that plant is going to stay open. When it's going to cost more to produce cars, even if they cut wages, even if taxes are brutally cut, when the producer price index is skyrocketing as it is now, I don't know that there's much that the British government could do unless they want to have negative taxes for these companies and just subsidize the heck out of them. I mean, that's the only thing that might save these companies. But Theresa May's austerity-drunk conservative government isn't one that's likely to subsidize corporations in either the short or the long term. Arliss?
Well, today I'm talking about the decline of pollinators and bees in particular. And there are about 20,000 bee species in the world. Bees pollinate 25% of the food consumed in the U.S., and pollinators pollinate 5 to 8% of the world food supply directly. That comes to about $235 to $577 billion in annual output, depending on how you calculate it. It's jobs for many millions of people all over the world. And the world agriculture output that is dependent upon pollination has surged 300% in the last 50 years. Western honeybees produce about 1.6 million tons of honey in a year, in a given year. And honeybees are much more social than other species of bee. So studies focused on them don't always equally apply to wild bees. And we're only just figuring that out. More than three quarters of the types of global food crops that exist are improved, at least in yield and quality, by pollinators. So for us to think that we can do without them or that we can survive this decrease is not acceptable. It's like thinking Brexit's going to work. It's not going to be functional. Especially dependent crops, by the way, include things like fruits, vegetables, seed, nut, and oil crops, coffee, God forbid chocolate, and here's the big crisis, carrots. For God's sake, carrots. The carrot crop is already being affected. Critical micronutrients, vitamins, and minerals for the human diet are affected by all of these things. So The EU has already severely restricted the use of the most harmful of pesticides, and that's a step in the right direction. The Obama administration has declared the decline to be so serious that it has become, quote unquote, economically unsustainable. The U.S. bee population dropped by 8% just last year alone. So President Obama in 2014 created a cross-agency task force, which has been funded to do both major research and habitat restoration. In Hawaii, and the reason that I bring this up now is that in Hawaii, on the 30th of September, seven species of yellow-faced or masked bees, which are native to Hawaii, have become the first bees to be added to the U.S. endangered and threatened species list. This followed years of study by the Xerxes Society, and please go online to their website. It's incredible. I'll put the link on our website, imhoppingmad.com, but it's xerxes.org, and I'm telling you, great website. What they found about these Hawaiian bees is that they pollinate plants which are indigenous to the islands, some of which are themselves endangered. And the thing about it is that bees specialize. Not all bees pollinate every kind of flower. So if you lose specific pollinators, you may also lose the flowers they're pollinating. And some of those endangered flowers, those endangered plants, are really very much dependent upon those yellow-masked bees. Habitat loss, wildfires, invasive non-native plants, invasive non-native insects, including especially ants, and feral pigs are the things that are most endangering these yellow-faced or masked bees. The prior week to September 30th, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Agency proposed putting the rusty-patched bumblebee on the list as well. The rusty-patched bumblebee lives in the upper Midwest and northeastern states in the U.S. It is a prized pollinator that is in steep decline over the past two decades. And in fact, in Minnesota, in August, Governor Mark Dayton, who's a Democrat, in case you wonder why it matters whether you vote Democrat or Republican, set serious limits on the use of pesticides which are targeting and harming these bees. He did it by executive order, and in spite of farmers being upset that they now have to be essentially released or verified to be in imminent threat of significant crop loss before they can put certain kinds of pesticides on their crops, he's done it anyway. So what's killing these bees? Well, what they're finding is that it's both very complicated and interrelated. Probably the biggest culprit is something that's called a neonicotinoid or a neonic pesticide. And these are absorbed systemically, especially into the brain. They prevent bees from learning. For instance, a bee can't identify the smell of nectar if it's got too much of this stuff in its system. They inhibit reproduction. And honeybees actually really like neonicotinoid-laced crops, but they basically become drunk and they can't find their way back home. Neonics are leaching into soils on farms where they're used on the crops, and they're actually even getting into the wildflowers. So even though farmers are planting wildflowers specifically to support bee populations, it's not helping because the neonics get into those flowers as well. There is significant habitat loss, of course, and part of that is because mass flowering crops, like, say, oilseed rape, they flower all at once. Well, then all of that space is used up by something that isn't flowering after that particular crop is gone to seed or has gone into the next stage of its development. Well, bees throughout the entire foraging season need to have a steady source of supply, and they need to have a varied diet. Part of what's killing bees is that their diets are inadequate. Bees can adapt to another source of pollen if they lose a favored source, which is great. It's a plasticity that will help them survive, but things like pollution, and again, invasive species, and especially pathogens, are becoming a big problem for them. As different species, and this is interesting about pathogens, as different species of bees are forced to share more flowers due to habitat decline, the bees are also spreading parasites and pathogens amongst themselves. And that didn't used to be the case because they all kind of kept to their own flowers, so to speak, but they're not doing that anymore. Climate change is, of course, a huge problem for bees, and we could have intuited that, but there's now a great deal of proof around it. And for instance, there's something called range contraction. As it gets hotter in the southwest of the United States, bumblebees are giving up the southernmost part of their range, but they aren't moving any further north, even though north of their range is now livable habitat for them. And there's also, for instance, in alpine meadows, flower declines are down by 60% over the last 40 years. So there's substantial climate change effects already coming into play for bee populations. There's an enormous amount of research going into this, as one might imagine. In the UK, where they're really doing some exceptional work, there was a study just put out in August of this year and published in the journal Nature, and they've conclusively proven that wild bees are being harmed by the oilseed rape crops and the increased acreage given over to that crop in the last few years. The advantages to bees of having the oilseed rape flowers available in abundance is completely outweighed by the harm that's caused. And if you don't know what oilseed rape does, it's used for canola oil. It's also used in fodder for animals, and it's closely related to kale and, of course, to rapini. It used to be that oilseed rape was only used to rest soil between more nutrient-demanding crops because it requires considerable and intensive management, read into that pesticides, but it has become a much more profitable crop, so it's being planted in a much larger amount. The most susceptible of wild bee populations in the UK have dropped by 30%. 62 species were studied, and the most susceptible of those include the buff-tailed bumblebee, the spines mason bee, and the furrow bee. And I'm going to put up on our site a picture of the buff-tailed bumblebee, because if you want a picture of a really cute bee, this is the bee for you. 10% of a reduction in species across the area being studied occurred. So I'm not talking about a 10% reduction in bees. I'm talking about a 10% reduction in species across the area where they were studying this in the UK. The decline in the bee population is firmly proven to be directly attributable to neonic pesticides. Even though other elements play some role, there's no question now that it's the neonics that are killing these bees. Oilseed rape is especially dangerous to bees because the neonic active compounds are expressed both on the surface of the plant and through the tissues, which means that it's the nectar and the pollen that are affected. Oilseed rape crops can be sprayed, but more commonly in the U.S., what's happening is that in advance of planting, the seeds themselves are soaked in the pesticide. So as it grows up through its entire life, that plant is loaded with these neonic pesticides. The UN has established something called the Intergovernmental Science Policy Platform on Biodiversity and Ecosystem Services. The acronym for this is IPBES, but I don't know how they say that. In other words, I don't know if they're calling it IPBES or what, but anyway, I'll call it IPBES for short right now. It's modeled on the UN panel on climate change in that it actually has no power, but it's able to study and make recommendations to nations so that nations know what to do, so they have information. 124 nations are participating. 80 scientists are working around the world. The first report came out in February of this year, and they stopped just short of declaring a full-scale threat to the world food supply. 37% of bees they found are declining, 31% of butterflies, of the species for which data is available. The problem with studying butterflies is that there's not data available on many of the species. In Europe, 40% of bee species are threatened. And there's a shortage of, what they're calling a data gap in Latin America, Africa, and Asia. They don't have a good baseline, so it's hard to know what the decline is. And the other thing is that insects aren't the only thing that do pollination. Bats and birds are also pollinators, and 16% of the pollinator species of bats and birds are on the threatened or endangered species list. In the United States, the USDA is actually doing a significant amount of work in conjunction in many ways with the EPA, and the USDA has something called the Carl Hayden Bee Research Center in Tucson, where they study extensively colony collapse disorder. There are 8 federal agencies involved in the task force studying bees in the U.S., several state departments of agriculture, a large number of scientists, and the USDA has 12 currently funded research projects. And again, they're investing heavily in habitat restoration, which is critical. So what can we do about all of this? Well, first of all, we have got to continue and loudly call for an end to the use of neonic pesticides. That's just, they're not acceptable on any level. They're not good for us. They're not good for bees. They need to go away. We need to help to raise a more diverse stable of pollinators. And we can do that by planting more. We can plant flowers, especially wildflowers, but even window box flowers help. So everybody, I know there's kind of a bias away from flowers among lots of liberals because we think, well, you can't eat them and they require water and resources. But those flowers are really needed now. They're needed for pollinators to survive. So everything you can do on your, you know, little porch of your condo, whatever, plant flowers. And if you can plant wildflowers in your backyard, in particular, wildflowers are essential because they tend to bloom through the whole foraging season. And that's really important for bees. The vegetable rapini is really good for bees. So if you have a vegetable garden, plant rapini. Certainly, obviously, reduce pesticide use in your own home, more organic farming, and this is the coolest thing. Participate in something called the Great Sunflower Project. Go to thegreatsunflowerproject.org or thegreatsunflower.org, and I'll put that link on our site as well, because it is, this is basically a survey. People are planting sunflowers, and then for a limited amount of time each week, you sit and watch your sunflowers or whatever other flowers you have, and you count the number of bees that visit them, and you identify those bees. And they've got all the resources to do that. And then you turn that information in so that this project, these scientists can gather information from all across the country. It's like watching the migratory bird count that the public helps scientists with every year. Remember that the thing about this to remember is that we turned around ozone depletion and we turned around eggshell thinning just by doing things differently. We can do that with bees too. The bee population can still be preserved. We just have to act now. It's in our grasp. Next up, Will be talking to us about dictators and Donald Trump here on Hopping Mad.
As Hillary Clinton has said, Vladimir Putin wants to support Donald Trump because he wants a puppet. And Trump is cozy with the Russians, maybe because of business relationships or something like that. But really, it seems that he wants to run his businesses like they do. We've all heard about Trump's criminal behavior, hiring undocumented workers, forcing them to work overtime shifts, refusing to pay them, and then threatening them with deportation. We've heard about the situation with Trump University, which is being investigated under the anti-organized crime RICO law. The connections that Trump might have with New York organized crime and how he avoided working with American steelworkers by working with a mafia-fronted concrete firm. We know about all this because of the reporting that's been done about it. And we know about all of this because of three other sources, of course, which are number one, you know it, number two, I know it, and number three, everybody knows it, which are apparently valid sources to cite in presidential elections now. But let's talk about Russian businesses and how privatization happened in Russia in the 1990s. Russia's economic system is often described as kleptocracy, ruled by thieves, where powerful people use corruption to enrich themselves. And that's certainly an accurate description of a lot of the way that business is done in post-Soviet Eurasia. Just to shine a spotlight onto how things happened, there are three men, the history of whom is quite interesting. Michael Cherny, and then the Lebed brothers, Alexei and Alexander. When Siberia was run by the Soviet Union, when Russia was run by the Soviet Union, the factories in Siberia produced a lot of aluminum. But when the Soviet Union collapsed, there were a lot of problems with running factories and running exports, and you had economic chaos. Yeltsin's government didn't handle the transition particularly well. And so what ended up happening was that armed former soldiers who hadn't been paid in a while marched into factories, announced that those factories belonged to them and were now their private property, and began conglomerating. Michael Cherny ran what was called the Trans World Group, which was the first massive private company in Russia since the end of the Soviet Union. And what Trans World Group did was engage with those former soldiers and create a business conglomerate. Now, the reason they were allowed to do this was twofold. Number one, by becoming a company, they were able to start exporting aluminum again, which allowed them to pay their workers and bring some kind of economy to areas that were suffering from complete economic chaos. And also because anytime someone challenged them, they would show up with guns and shut them down. In the case of Alexei Lebed, he'd been put in charge of the Khakassia Administrative Republic. And when he was challenged by the local government over his brother's activities, he performed what he called an armed audit of the local government.
An armed audit?
Yes. Include marching his soldiers in to the local media system and shutting down all of the newspapers and broadcasters and just taking over the local government. He eventually did go to jail. His brother, Alexander Lebed, didn't face any kind of consequence for similar illegal activities and eventually entered into politics. Alexander is known for suggesting that Russia could use a military dictator like Augusto Pinochet. He died in a helicopter crash in 2002, but was sort of a proto-Putin figure, one that never took absolute control. And these three men are all accused of being in bed with Russian organized crime in the same way that most of Russia's oligarchs are accused of organized criminal activities, just as Donald Trump is accused of operating businesses by an organized crime model, hence the RICO, which is a racketeer-influenced and corrupt organization investigation into Trump University, and his ties to organized crime, which he used to build some of his buildings. Donald Trump would fit in quite well with the Russian kleptocracy. So, of course, he's going to like the Russians. He does business the way they do. But beyond that, he seems to also have a similar foreign policy to the one that they do. He has a long history of praising strongmen. And let's just go through the list. He said nice things about Saddam Hussein. "We shouldn't have destabilized Saddam Hussein, right?" he said recently at a rally. "He was a bad guy, a really bad guy. But you know what he did well? He killed terrorists. He did that so good. They didn't read them the rights. They didn't talk. They were a terrorist. It was over. Today, Iraq is Harvard for terrorism. You want to be a terrorist? You go to Iraq. It's like Harvard, okay? So sad." It gets worse. In defense of Saddam Hussein's use of weapons of mass destruction against the Kurds, Trump said, "Saddam Hussein throws a little gas, everyone goes crazy. Oh, he's using gas." throwing a little gas, like sarin, might be something Trump thinks is acceptable then. What's a little indiscriminate murder of every living thing in a 30-mile radius between countries, eh?
Well, you know, there's Assad did the same thing with mustard gas, and doesn't Trump have something to say about that?
Nope. I haven't heard any quotes about Assad, other than Assad's a great guy.
Great guy.
Praised Assad. You know, he's also praised Kim Jong-un in North Korea, saying, if you look at North Korea, this guy, I mean, he's like a maniac, okay? And you've got to give him credit. He goes in, he takes over, and he's the boss. It's incredible. He wiped out the uncle. He wiped out this one, that one. He's referring, of course, to reports from Korean and Japanese media that Kim Jong-un had his father's brothers torn apart by dogs because they represented a threat to his rule. Just by being alive, they could be another descendant of the sort of holy, you know, god emperor that is his grandfather. That's a great thing to praise in Trump's mind.
Despicable.
Yeah.
Yep. Basket of deplorables.
Trump's also praised the Tiananmen Square massacre, saying, I said that it is a strong, powerful government that put that riot down with strength, and they kept down the riot. And that's not the prevailing wisdom in China either. To give a little background about that, Deng Xiaoping was the Chinese premier at the time, but as a chairman of one of the councils of the Communist Party, he didn't wield unlimited power. After the death of Mao, Deng began a series of reforms which included a willingness to talk to the West. He famously met with Richard Nixon to talk about trade and warming relations. One of Deng's allies in the modernization of China was a man named Hu Yaobang. Hu was a radical reformer, and his death is part of what spurred on the Tiananmen Square protests. The hardliners used those protests as an excuse for an anti-modernization crackdown. Some of Deng's allies ended up under house arrest. Deng's premiership was threatened, and essentially he had to abandon modernization until 1992, when he was able to push things forward again. He's said to prime ministers and interviewers recently that he had to step back and allow the Tiananmen Square massacre to happen because opposing the hardliners might have triggered a civil war. Trump has praised this, but this wasn't an act of strength by a powerful leader like Deng Xiaoping. This was an act of desperation by old ideological hardliners who were trying to keep control of their country no matter what the cost, even if it meant spilling the blood of their own people and going after their own leader. So,
well, Trump is willing to spill the blood of Americans if he doesn't win the election.
Yeah, he said he'll accept the result of the election if he wins.
If he wins.
Yeah. You know, he's talked about killing people's families, American citizens, if one of their family members is a terrorist. He looks not like a strong leader, but as Clinton said, a Putin puppet. Think about the other puppets of Putin. You have Yanukovych in Ukraine. And we've talked about Yanukovych in the past on this program, how he had his military attack unarmed protesters and gun them down. How he engaged in absolutely brutal suppression of the pro-democracy, pro-EU movement in Ukraine, Maidan. I don't see Trump as any different from that, especially with his cavalier relationship with the law. And looking at another person who's made positive statements about Vladimir Putin, Duterte, in the Philippines, Duterte has encouraged vigilante murder, calling for the mass execution of drug dealers by regular citizens. And the result is that blood is flowing through the streets of Manila as anyone with a grudge takes it out on their enemies and simply announces to the world that their enemy was a drug dealer. No evidence needed.
And there's a bounty, isn't there? People get paid for killing.
Yeah. You get paid for killing people now. So if you're a regular old criminal, you can just hunt down anyone you want, kill them, put some marijuana in their pockets, and drag them out and say, this person was a drug dealer I just killed. Found him with marijuana, and we got the guy. So you now have roving gangs. That's Duterte's Philippines. And Duterte has said nice things about Vladimir Putin and expressed a willingness to work with Russia and China on the South China Sea, which is an absolute reversal of the Philippines' attempts to secure their own territorial integrity. That's not good for the Philippines. Neither, of course, is having their citizens murder each other for money. And then there's Assad, while not necessarily a puppet, is certainly a close ally of Putin. He's used sarin gas, like Saddam did, which is a war crime. And presumably Trump wouldn't mind throwing a little gas around. Then there's the positive statements that Trump has made about Gaddafi in Libya, saying, you know, if Gaddafi and Saddam were around, that the Middle East would be a more stable place. And we know that isn't true because we saw how the Islamic State has grown under Assad. Remember that it started under the brutal regime of Assad. It didn't start in Iraq, which was supposedly so weak to terrorists. It started under the regime of one of these strong men that, according to Trump, is just supposed to be able to go out and kill terrorists and all that. If Gaddafi were in charge, the Islamist groups in Libya, which are still sort of fighting a civil war, wouldn't have just vanished. They would have still fought. You would still have had chaos. And when the United States went in to Libya, it was because the Libyan military had announced they were planning to massacre the population of any region which opposed Gaddafi. They were going to indiscriminately kill citizens of Libya, civilians, going house to house. And so France and the UK, because Libya is just across the Mediterranean from France, decided an intervention was necessary. And the United States supported them. There was going to be chaos either way. And so we chose the option of chaos without genocide. Not a great thing to pick, but it's the decision we made. And if you look at Rwanda and what happened in the genocide there, you need to remember that inaction has just as many bloody consequences as intervention. But Trump doesn't see the world that way. He sees the world as full of wonderful dictators that can just stamp down on protests and everything will be fine. We also see Erdogan in Turkey becoming closer with Putin in a way that's extremely worrying. Donald Trump doesn't praise these men because he likes dictators. He praises these men because he wants to be one of them. He wants to be the boss. He wants to be like Kim Jong-un, having anybody who opposes his power ripped apart by dogs. He wants to be the Chinese government gunning down protesters. He wants to be Saddam Hussein, killing terrorists without any legal recourse and gassing anyone he pleases. He wants to be Vladimir Putin. He wants to be Duterte and give his supporters carte blanche to murder. Trump's love of these men shines a spotlight on who Trump himself is and what Trump himself wants. Coming up, Arliss will be talking about the Audit the Fed movement here on Hopping Matt.
We're back on Hopping Mad, and before I begin, I should say that we don't have an interview today. We had a great interview scheduled, but it fell through the cracks at the last minute, and we were sorry about that, but actually, Will and I had a lot to say today, so it probably worked out okay. So I will do part of my section on Audit the Fed in the primary show, the part that gets broadcast, but the rest of it will flow into Extra Mad. So please come back and listen to the rest of the section on Audit the Fed on our podcast, which you can find at iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and we're now available on MyTuner and TuneIn, or at our website, imhoppingmad.com. So let's talk about this whole Audit the Fed thing. You hear this, you know, floating around in sort of the atmosphere during this election. We've heard it more on the Republican side, but it is also present on the far left. So let's talk about this. What we're talking about is the Federal Reserve Transparency Act, also called Audit the Fed. It's about auditing the Fed, right? Silly you. No, it's a Trojan horse, and it's designed to make monetary policy subject to politics. It's sponsored by Kentucky's own senator and ophthalmologist, Rand Paul. It has 29 co-sponsors, or it had, by the way, it's been defeated. But it had 29 co-sponsors, including Rubio and Cruz. So those of you on the far left, you are agreeing with something Rand Paul, Marco Rubio, and Ted Cruz want badly. That should be an indicator to you that there's probably something wrong with it.
Because, you know, working with fascists is a wonderful thing to do, right?
Yeah, exactly. No. There was an identical bill introduced in the House, by the way, by Kentucky Congressman Thomas Massey. And Rand's daddy, Ron Paul, the Texas congressman and obstetrician, and I, by the way, I refer to their professions so you can understand these guys aren't some kind of magical financial experts. They're doctors. And it, as I understand it, they're not even very good doctors. But Rand Paul not only introduced similar legislation, but he wrote a book called End the Fed, because he thinks we should completely get rid of the Federal Reserve and go back to the gold standard. So both Pauls are long-standing opponents of fiat currency. And here's a quote from an article that was in the Wall Street Journal in February of 2015 by David Wessel, and it's, I think it kind of summarizes what Rand Paul is thinking pretty clearly. Quote, in a speech at an Audit the Fed rally in Iowa, Mr. Paul derided GAO audits because they, quote, tell us what they spent on coffee and donuts, but nothing about the $4.5 trillion in assets. And folks, I just want you to stop here and think, how does he know that there are $4.5 trillion in assets if it's not in the audit? Anyway, moving on. The $4.5 trillion in assets that the Fed owns, of which more than $2 trillion is said to be troubled. Who knows what that's worth? If $2 trillion is distressed and not of value, what if it's worth 10 cents? They're 90% off? That would mean that they're insolvent and we would have a terrible problem. And here I interject again because no, all of the assets could fail. All of the assets could fail. And the Fed would just tap on a keyboard and recreate that money because we are a sovereign, floating, fiat currency issuer with all our debt in our own currency. The Fed just taps on a keyboard. So the reporter continues, journalist.
But starve the beast?
Yeah, exactly.
Like, if we all stop paying our taxes, like, we could get rid of the government and, yeah, you know, then freedom or something.
Freedom or something. Freedom somehow. Freedom. Yeah. The freedom to have bad roads.
No. Not bad roads. I want to own the roads. I'll own the roads and charge everybody money for them.
Yeah, silly me.
And I'll own the schools and the entire town, and everybody has to pay me rent because I want to be like friggin' a duke or something.
Like a plutocrat or a kleptocrat?
I think. No, an actual duke. I want a royal title, which I'm free to grant myself.
That's right.
Yeah.
Okay. Duke Will. So David Wessel, the journalist, continues, Mr. Paul is wrong. I covered the Fed for more than 25 years. I can't find any GAO report on the Fed website that reveals what the Fed spends on coffee and donuts. I did, however, learn in a Fed report by the Fed's Inspector General that at Fed-sponsored conferences, alcohol may be served, but only after 5:30 p.m. and for no longer than 90 minutes. We do, however, know plenty about what's in the Fed's $4.5 trillion portfolio, down to the CUSIP number of each of its securities. So That's from the Wall Street Journal. And the thing about it is there's populist support on both the far left and the far right for this audit the Fed idea from basically people who, based upon what they have to say about the Fed, clearly don't understand what the Fed does. And the alarming number of conspiracy theories, again, both on the left and on the right, is indicative of how little people understand of how the Fed works. None of this is improved by the simple fact that what the Fed does is complex and subtle, and that when the Fed speaks, they become propeller heads, and they do it in words that the masses can't possibly understand. Well, that's understandable in terms of what they're speaking about. They're speaking about something really complex, but they do probably need to do a better job of speaking to people who don't speak their same language. Sadly, Senator Sanders has joined in this audit the Fed craze, and he voted for the bill, which fortunately was defeated. But I think he did it with better intent, and I'll talk more on that later. There are some specific things that he's interested in that weren't in the bill, but I think that they are important, and we'll get to those. People got especially mad at the Fed during the global financial crisis. A lot of people did, all across the political spectrum. First of all, the Fed was really visible. There's all this bad stuff going on, and the Fed was really visible. But people didn't understand what the Fed was doing, and the Fed was spending billions of dollars that, quote unquote, we couldn't afford to rescue banks. Well, there's no such thing as we couldn't afford, as we talk about over and over on this program. But, of course, the Fed did put a lot of money into rescuing banks. And that is, and I'll talk about this again later in this show, but the Fed made a decision to rescue banks as opposed to pouring more money into Main Street. And that is something that probably was not the best possible decision, or some combination of working with Wall Street and working with Main Street should have been policy, but that's not the way it worked, and that's something that can and should be corrected. And again, Senator Sanders is right about that. The primary effect of audit the Fed, and here's the thing you need to be really aware of and really understand. The primary effect of audit the Fed would be to make federal monetary decisions subject to congressional review on a meeting-by-meeting basis. It would put all intra-FOMC and all intra-staff discussions at the Fed open to congressional review immediately. It would make the Fed subject to GAO recommendations on monetary policy. So the GAO would be making the monetary policy decisions. So it's not the Fed doing it where they're experts. It's the GAO where they're accountants. I'm not sure that moves us any farther forward. In fact, I'm entirely sure that it doesn't. Unfettered reviews of Fed actions and thoughts. Imagine Congress. Imagine the people who gave you 14 Benghazi special committee hearings reviewing the Fed. In unlimited numbers of hearings, it would be what I think of as Ryan League. There's a progression of leagues in my book. There's Bush League, then there's Ryan League, then there's Cruz League for the things that are really appalling. This would be Ryan League because it would be an endless, ongoing, infinite series of hearings about every single policy that comes out of the Federal Reserve. So the same people who could not pass a law to address the Zika crisis all summer this year would now be taking on monetary policy. And they want to remove the Fed's current self-funded state of being and make the Fed dependent upon congressional funding, because that's working so well for the entire rest of the federal bureaucracy. Imagine this. You wake up one morning and the stock market is plunging. Banks are closing their doors. No one's answering the phone at any insurance company. So Congress decides to take a vote on whether or not to lower the interest rate in 6 months. And the bill would also make all abortion illegal, because they could do that kind of thing. Or if that seems too extreme to you, realize that, think about it this way. Congress recognizes that there's an election coming in a couple of months, and they direct the GAO to direct the Fed to lower interest rates by a full point. Okay, so loans are cheaper and consumers refinance, and suddenly they have a lot more money to spend. And just after the election, because there's a delay built into these things, all of a sudden you have skyrocketing inflation. And of course, Congress knew this would happen when they directed the GAO to drop the interest rates. But they sacrificed the midterm success of the economy or solidity of the economy for the short term so that they could get reelected. Audit the Fed means that the Federal Reserve and our monetary policy is at the whim of people who have to get reelected every 2 years. And remember, by involving Congress in something which is as time-sensitive and inordinately complex as monetary policy, we are expecting Congress to understand the mechanisms and inherently convoluted nature of monetary policy. This from a body that can't agree that it took more than 7 days to create the planet we're standing on. It should be pointed out that both Elizabeth Warren and Sherrod Brown opposed this bill, and on January 12th of this year, the Senate defeated it. But it will come back, and that's why it's worth talking about. But wait, there's more. In another bill in the House, they were looking at requiring the Fed to operate monetary policy based on a specific equation with no flexibility allowed. And there's no central bank on the planet that doesn't build into its system a certain amount of flexibility based on what's really going on or what they think is coming. So if they did this, if they tied the Fed to a specific formula that they choose, that Congress chooses, if the Fed was to go outside the formula, then individual governors and the Fed would be subject to investigation and hearings up on Capitol Hill. And it would also eliminate the ability of the Fed to create emergency liquidity of any kind. So if we got into the global financial crisis with this in place, we would have gone not into recession, but into depression. So why are so many people so anxious to hurdle themselves off this particular cliff? Well, there are conspiracy theories, and they can be powerful. And because they think that the Fed really did do something illegal, and if not that, at least very wrong during the global financial crisis. They also think that the Fed was reckless and threw money away. And they think that the Fed's actions were ineffective. They think that what the Fed did during the global financial crisis didn't work. And finally, they think that the Fed operated in great secrecy and was not accountable. I have a lot more to say about this, and I'll come back to it in Extra Mad. Will and I send out our thanks to the team at Netroots Radio, and especially to you for joining us today on Hopping Mad. You can find the broadcast version of our show on Netroots Radio Mondays at 8 a.m. The podcast version, which usually includes Extra Mad's extended interview, is always available on Stitcher, iTunes, Google Play, and now on MyTuner and TuneIn. Our website is imhoppingmad.com, and you can either listen to or download the show there. We welcome your comments, thoughts, tweets, and suggestions, either through the website or via Twitter at imhoppingmad. Will is on Twitter at willmcleod99, and I'm there, of course, at arlessbunny. Next up is K-Grow in the Morning here on Netroots Radio. We're back with Extra Mad on Hopping Mad, and now I'm going to talk to you about what actually happened during the global financial crisis. The threat of the global financial crisis to the U.S. economy was larger than the Great Depression was, had it gone unchecked, had the Fed not stepped in. And dropping rates to virtual zero was not enough to halt what actually happened. The Fed's actions during the global financial crisis were unprecedented in size and scope, and that did look frightening to people. It's understandable why people were concerned about that. But it doesn't mean that it wasn't the right thing to do. In other words, just because it scares you doesn't mean it isn't the right thing to have had happen. The Fed used its emergency lending authority, which was set into law during the Great Depression, for this economic disaster. In the 1930s, Congress realized that the Fed was going to need special authority during the rare events when a disaster, an economic disaster, happened. The Fed has not had to use that between then and the global financial crisis. So that's why it was unfamiliar to everybody. That's why people didn't recognize what was going on. From USA Today on the 3rd of February, 2015, and I love this, just this little quip, under former Chairman Ben Bernanke, the Fed created more than $3 trillion out of thin air to keep the U.S. economy afloat, unquote. I'm sorry, but everybody in modern monetary theory loved that. That's the Fed chairman basically using modern monetary theory, using exactly what we all keep telling you is the way it works. He tapped on a keyboard, $3 trillion appeared. Magic. Only It's for real. Loans were made to banks. And this is the kind of thing you hear Senator Sanders talking about that he's so concerned about. But I think that that concern is misplaced because loans were made to banks through the standard process via the discount window. They didn't alter their process or their requirements, even though things were desperate, even though they were being aggressive in terms of policy. Borrowers had to be solvent, as in the accounting term of art, solvent, not just, hey, we say we're solvent. Interest rates were very low, but borrowers had to pay interest, and all loans had to be secured in the usual way. Usually, by the way, that means they had to be secured with treasuries. The terms and conditions and amounts of all those loans were immediately disclosed on the Fed's website, and the Fed created a specialized website for Congress, which included all of the above plus details such as the quantity and quality of the collateral involved. Loans made to other financial institutions were made with the same requirements. So if the failure of a company, and here think AIG, was judged to be something severe enough to bring down the entire economy, the Fed said, okay, we're going to make this loan, but we're going to make it with the following requirements. And AIG had to abide by all of those things. Loans were made in a few rare cases to non-financial firms, which were also judged to be of outsized impact to the economy. The Fed additionally bought back really large amounts of long-term treasury debt, adding liquidity into the marketplace. This money wasn't expected to be added back into the economy, to be spent into the economy by the Federal Reserve for years. But during the global financial crisis, the Fed put out a call for long-term securities. Anybody wanted to sell them, lots of folks did, and the Fed bought those back in. The Fed also dramatically increased their public and intergovernmental communications, and that's where people really get it wrong. People talk about the Fed working in secrecy, but actually the Fed put out an enormous amount of information during this period of time. They communicated with a lot of people. They worked with a lot of committees, emergency committees in Washington. They pushed information around as much as possible and out into the public as much as possible. And they began something called forward guidance. And we hear that phrase now used commonly, but it was new then. Forward guidance means it's the Fed saying, this is what we plan to do. And that was considered really unconventional at the time. And when you hear people talking about the Fed taking unconventional actions, forward guidance is one of those things. The Fed talking about what they were going to do is one of those things. The Fed ceasing to be secretive was one of those things. Also, unconventionally, the Fed purchased $1.7 trillion in troubled mortgage-backed securities from banks. Okay, there's a lot of sensitivity around this, and I get why that would be. But these securities are all guaranteed by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. And, folks, we have a fiat currency. The Fed can't fail. So it doesn't matter if all of these go under. Oh, well, a couple of keystrokes, and you're back to rights again. The Fed can't fail. It doesn't matter if the Fed is holding weak assets. Note, I want you to all note that Congress, who's screaming and yelling about this, these congressmen that are screaming and yelling about this stuff, they could have stepped in and eliminated the debt ceiling and then generated a truly massive fiscal policy targeted spending package, much larger than the actually quite minimal stimulus. This would have provided fill behind the Fed's monetary policy, and it would have eliminated the need for the Fed's ongoing aggressive monetary policy. So a lot of these things the Fed had to do, they would not have had to do if Congress could have done their job. But of course, if wishes were horses, dreamers would ride. But Congress doesn't understand the economy any better than they understand why Marines could not beam themselves directly to Benghazi a la Star Trek, or that Hawaiian birth certificates are valid. Ultimately, Congress was unable to formulate a serious fiscal policy response, and because it was helpful for other reasons, the Fed ultimately engaged in quantitative easing. Here's the really important takeaway from this whole section. Every loan that the Federal Reserve made, every single loan the Federal Reserve made, was paid back in full on time with interest. Repeat after me. In full, on time with interest. Meanwhile, other central banks in the world that were affected by the global financial crisis, instead of being aggressive like the Fed was, they engaged in additional austerity. And all of those economies suffered, without exception. Most have observed the success of the Fed's actions and have changed their policies as a result, or at least done a little more in that direction. So the Fed should be audited, though, right? I mean, come on, the Fed should be audited. They shouldn't just be able to do whatever they want and nobody be paying attention. Well, yeah, but it already is audited a lot. It's audited by the Office of the Inspector General, who audits all of the Fed's programs except its direct monetary policy, and it makes that full audit public on the web. And it already audits the Fed's lending and now the regulatory facilities around that lending. The Government Accountability Office, formerly known as the Government Accounting Office, it already does a regular audit of all aspects of the Fed, including their lending programs, with the sole exception, again, of auditing monetary policy, which is forbidden by law from auditing. And that's because in 1978, as a result of political meddling, Congress passed a law forbidding the GAO from auditing the Fed's monetary policy thinking and actions. Under Dodd-Frank, we've also audited the Fed's emergency lending program and the federal government's structure where required in order to understand what was done during that period of time. On the GAO website, right now, there are over 70 reports issued since the global financial crisis, which cover the Fed's lending operations during the global financial crisis. These are all currently publicly available, and they've been that way for years. Additionally, the Fed is always audited by an outside independent auditor. Right now, the company with that contract is Deloitte & Touche. Right now, the General Inspector for the Troubled Assets Recovery Program also audits the Fed's lending facility as it applies to TARP loans. And the congressionally established Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission has thoroughly reviewed the Fed's actions during the global financial crisis, as was their mandate. Furthermore, the Fed publishes its balance sheet, wait for it, weekly. And the Fed publishes its fully audited balance sheet annually. Every single Treasury security which is currently issued and out there is included on a Fed website and is available by its number for review. So I'm not sure what people think they don't know about what the Fed's doing. It's all there. It's all available on a website. You just have to go and look at it. But come on. Economists all over the world are divided on this, aren't they? You know, different opinions. Well, yeah. They're precisely as divided on this subject as scientists are divided on the subject of climate change. Get me? Economists aren't divided on this subject. Economists have debated and studied the advantages and disadvantages of independent central banks so much that they have an actual acronym for it. They call them ICBs, independent central banks. And they have done enough studies and have verified each other's work, like you're supposed to do in peer-reviewed journals and peer-reviewed studies. All major studies show that in both developed and developing nations, ICBs reduce the volatility of inflation and increase economic stability everywhere. Also, ICBs are only able to focus on long-term economic stability if they do not have to worry about short-term political considerations. Repeated outside, and when I say outside, I mean outside of this country, research has shown that so-called unconventional policy measures taken by the Fed, including the massive loans made, are a significant reason why the U.S. economy recovered faster and remains stronger than all other economies affected by the global financial crisis, in particular Europe, where the European Central Bank did not begin a similar policy until last year. Studies have shown that the Fed saved the U.S. economy from full-blown depression. Critics have screamed that the Fed's actions would lead directly to hyperinflation, which clearly has not happened. And you've heard me say this before, that's because inflation is hard to get to. Inflation is difficult to achieve. You don't just fall into it. It doesn't sneak up on you on cat's paws. Economists agree that despite the current low wage growth, had the Fed's policies not been so aggressive and accommodative, wage deflation would have been the case. And a survey by the University of Chicago's Booth Graduate School of Business was taken of economists across the country, and literally none of them thought that audit the Fed was a good idea. Zero. Zip. None. But central banks do make mistakes, right? Big ones. They make mistakes. Yeah. The global financial crisis was, to the Fed, as the result of a great idea is to Wile E. Coyote. The Fed and the European Central Bank totally missed the oncoming train. Alan Greenspan's Fed left interest rates low for way too long and let the housing bubble boom up underneath them. And part of that was just because Alan Greenspan himself thought he knew better than everybody else. And he was an adamant believer in the Chicago School economic theory that the market regulates itself and is naturally efficient. So there are things that must be improved about oversight for central banks. The Wile E. Coyote management style can't run U.S. monetary policy. The Fed must get smarter. As a start, Fed oversight and accountability was improved through Dodd-Frank in a positive and fruitful way. Even Fed governors are willingly and publicly talking about the need to do more and to increase and facilitate the oversight of the Fed in ways that make sense. Congress has already got considerable influence over the Fed. Decades ago, Congress set the Fed's goal as maximum employment and stable prices. The president appoints and the Senate confirms the Fed chair and seven of the Fed's board of governors. The Fed chair must report to Congress and to the public and give testimony twice a year in hearings specifically focused on monetary policy. And at those hearings, the Fed chair must demonstrate that they are meeting the congressional mandate. And that committee does hold the chair accountable when things are screwed up. The Fed must provide considerable communication and information to various congressional committees throughout the year. So what more does Senator Sanders want? Well, first of all, he says that the Fed made $16 trillion in secret loans to bail out American and foreign banks. Well, first of all, those loans weren't secret. And when Sanders says things like that, he drives fear and decreases actual informed debate. When he fails to note little details like all of those loans were paid off, repeat after me, in full, on time, and with interest. There are a handful of foreign banks that receive loans, but there are also that same handful of foreign banks that have a very large effect on the U.S. economy. Senator Sanders thinks that Congress should have a direct say in which banks receive loans through the discount window. He thinks Congress should get involved in the day-to-day function of the Federal Reserve. Senator Sanders calls what happened during the global financial crisis to be socialism for the banks, and you're on your own for everyone else. And he's right about that. But what happens to my bank does affect me. Senator Sanders is very concerned, and I think legitimately, about the conflict of interest involved in those who actively own stock in banks while sitting on the board of governors or in the management of the Fed regional banks. And there are ways to address this, like blind trusts. But thinking that it makes sense to have the Fed run without any bankers is crazy talk. Bankers' expertise is absolutely essential, but there are options to make this situation better. There is compromise ground available between all and nothing. The other thing that Senator Sanders is upset about is that the Fed farms out certain oversight of loan management responsibilities, and they often do that with bidding contracts. But during the global financial crisis, this was done on a no-bid basis in many instances. I think Senator Sanders needs to open up his dictionary and look up the word crisis and also the word emergency. And again, those loans were paid back, repeat after me, in full, on time, and with interest. Senator Sanders is not wrong in wanting more input into Fed policies which will favor families and Main Street over the wealthy and Wall Street. But there are reasonable ways to do that without damaging the function of the Fed. The Fed has significantly increased transparency in recent years. Alan Greenspan did not help, and he was basically opposed to Fed transparency. He kept the Fed secretive, and he essentially, his vision of the Fed was like the Oracle of Delphi. But first under Ben Bernanke, and now even more so under Janet Yellen, the Fed has pushed dramatically to increase transparency and public engagement, in fact. Chair Yellen has repeatedly stated and acted upon her belief that Fed transparency and increased communication, including forward guidance, is good for the economy and helps monetary policy to work more effectively. The Fed has this, if you haven't been there, you really should go. They have a truly exceptional and unexpectedly deep website. All kinds of information, including an interactive balance sheet, which is incredibly cool. The minutes of all FOMC meetings are published 3 weeks after the meetings themselves, and the complete transcripts of FOMC meetings are published 5 years after the meeting, which is really useful for academics and economists who are trying to figure out how things work and to study economics as a whole. Transcripts of governor's speeches and other public appearances are published on the Fed's website, and in fact, they're given in the first place, which did not used to be the case. And governors are actually encouraged to speak publicly about their own opinions, including opinions that may differ from their colleagues. And that's new. And the reason that Yellen wants to see that out there is so that the public can learn what the FOMC is thinking and that there are varying viewpoints and that those viewpoints are represented when the FOMC is having its meetings. Fed policymakers release each quarter their own individual economic forecasts, and those are on the Fed website. And the Fed chair now gives at least 4 televised press conferences a year where, frankly, the press is asking much more informed and informative questions than congressmen during congressional hearings. So what makes sense? What should we really be thinking about doing? What would help? Well, first of all, we really have to accept the absolute fact that the Fed must be able to do its job without consideration of politics or partisanship. Audit the Fed is nothing short of dangerous on the same scale as putting the Supreme Court under the thumb of Congress. Already, Congress has given the Fed the means to resolve, in other words, break up or close, SIFIs, which are systemically important financial institutions, that become problematic. The Fed did not have that power before. Already, Congress has prohibited loans to individual firms while still maintaining the Fed's right to create broader lending programs as necessary in an emergency. Those things happened as part of Dodd-Frank, and those are reasonable responses. But I think Main Street must have a much more prominent and powerful seat at the table and on the FOMC. I agree to a point that we need to limit the number of bankers on the Fed's Board of Governors and on the FOMC, but I do not believe we can completely eliminate them. Their experience, their expertise, their voice is critical in making wise and broadly deliberative policy. A banker or broker should probably not be the Fed chair. And in fact, I don't even think that bankers or brokers should be regional Fed presidents. I think those positions ought to go to academics, to economists, to somebody else, but they should not go to people who are industry. Bank-related personal assets should be moved into blind trusts. And nobody can have an active position in bank management. In other words, as was the case, and as Senator Sanders has so rightfully pointed out, you cannot be running Chase Bank and be sitting on the New York Federal Reserve Board. Also, bankers should probably not have a voting majority on the Board of Governors. People with other interests and other priorities should probably comprise the majority on the Federal Reserve Board of Governors. Dodd-Frank has mandated stress test documentation, but the documentation that gets provided to Congress and ultimately to the public ends up being so highly edited as to be useless. And that documentation needs to be made fully available to the public with minor exceptions for the protection of highly sensitive company data, but everything else needs to be seen. There are ways to reasonably increase oversight without damaging the Fed's ability to act quickly and with the flexibility necessary in order to respond to an economy in crisis. But first, Congress must get better educated on the way the Fed really works, as opposed to how they think it works. Perhaps they need something that's comparable to the CBO, which evaluates and explains the impact of fiscal policy to them in small words. Maybe they need something like that to explain monetary policy to them, even though they don't make monetary policy. Maybe they still need a small little body of people that explains monetary policy to them in words of 2 syllables or less. And finally, liberals must stop being paranoid and get informed about the real and specific problems which exist in Fed oversight. And for that, I really recommend that you go to the website of Citizens for Financial Reform. It's a great place to start. We've had Alexis Goldstein of Citizens for Financial Reform on this show, and she's the perfect example of how expert these folks are, how grounded they are, and their voice is inordinately important in this debate.
We as a species, as nations, as societies are letting our problems go to waste. Climate change, inequality, poverty, these problems should be driving our species forward into our next scientific era. Instead, we're allowing them to destroy us. This is something I wanted to talk about for a while, but I just haven't had time, so I'm glad we have time today. In my view, to prepare for our future, we need three things. Infrastructure, which we've talked about. Investment in climate change mitigation, including developing technologies to fight drought and developing new cropland. And finally, massive investments in space technology. And it's those last two that I want to talk about most today. But the infrastructure argument is pretty simple. We should be transitioning to a clean energy transport system. That means better mass transit, high-speed rail, transitioning away from current levels of air travel, and the development of green energy infrastructure. All of that means jobs and manufacturing, and all of that has been talked pretty much to death. But another expansion that hasn't been considered when we talk about infrastructure is growing agriculture both to become more sustainable and to fight poverty. Climate change should lead to a revolution in both food technology and energy technology. Now, the locavore movement is part of that. Small farms, urban farming, growing more food closer to where it's consumed. That's important. Farm to table, as some restaurants do, or what's being called from table to farm, where restaurants are seeking out farmers they can work with on organic produce. All of that is massively important, as is new ways of growing food that are being developed in Jordan and Oman, where people are going into the deserts and finding wadis, dry lake beds, and then setting up mulch and swale and trying to hold in what little rainfall there is, and then growing date palms and other food-producing plants that grow naturally in those regions. All of that is important. But there's another set of technologies that scare people that I also think are important, and that's genetically modified crops. Now, genetically modified food scares people for some very good reasons. I think the best example of that would be plants that have the neonicotinoids that Arliss discussed at the beginning of this program already soaked into the seed, as well as plants like Roundup Ready soybeans, which I think are one of the worst kinds of GMO crops because the modification makes those soybeans immune to possibly carcinogenic defoliants. And those defoliants are then sprayed in ridiculous amounts onto those plants, which means that they get into humans in, I don't mean just trace amounts, I mean humans have large amounts of glyphosate in their systems if they are either eating large amounts of these genetically modified crops or, and this is a problem in my view too, if they work on these crops, if they're exposed to the chemicals. But that kind of GMO is very different, in my view, than something like golden rice. 3 million children die every year from vitamin A deficiency in the developing world. Golden rice could solve that problem. It's a transgenic strain of rice which contains genes from several other plants and produces in one bowl the daily value any person needs of vitamin A. It could save millions of lives every year, especially in impoverished communities that are being struck by drought and famine, as could the newer transgenic crops that are designed to grow in poor soil conditions or survive drought. These genetically modified plants aren't the sort of frankenfoods that are warned about. They're not created with pesticides inside of them. They are simply plants that have been selectively mixed with other plants in the same way that humans have been doing for centuries. For those who want a natural world, well, the fact is that nothing we eat is natural. Nothing. Every apple we've ever eaten is a clone. All apples are produced via grafting, where cuttings of an apple tree are removed from a tree that's found to be particularly tasty and grafted onto a tree that someone has decided to use to grow more apples. It is those grafts from that have essentially been cloned from another tree that produce the apples. Apples not produced through grafting, and wild apples do exist, but they aren't really fit for human consumption. They're only really useful for cider, and they don't taste particularly good. You know, the same thing is true of a lot of citrus and other fruits. Florida oranges that I would eat growing up are produced by grafting Valencia orange cuttings onto tiny sour lemon trees. Same thing is true of animals. Almost every farm animal we ever eat has been selectively bred and genetically modified by old-fashioned domestication techniques to be tastier, plumper, or, in the case of domestic pigs, easier to care for. Wild boars, the same species as domestic pigs, are covered in hair, but our domestic pigs are bald. We've been using technology we developed over the course of the past 30,000 years, since the very beginnings of domestication and the agricultural revolution, to slowly, over time, genetically modify the species of animals that we've domesticated. The same thing is true of plants. Properly used and properly regulated, genetic modification allows us to do the same thing, just much faster and more accurately, without the worry of creating monocultures that can be wiped out by famines. Those technologies, combined with infrastructure development and projects like solar desalination, can mitigate the worst effects of climate change. They can produce jobs. They can save communities from the chaos that starts war. MI6 did a really interesting study that says no matter where you are in the world, no matter how advanced our society, we're only ever 3 meals away from total anarchy. Now, in the West, in wealthier countries in the East as well, in Japan and China, we have emergency management agencies. In the United States, it's FEMA, and we have first responders, and they've learned a lot about how to handle those things, but a lot of the rest of the world isn't so lucky. Drought, economic catastrophe, and famine are all major contributors to the rise of the Arab Spring, and also to what, with the rise of ISIS, is being called the Arab Winter. There's another thing we need to be doing to better ourselves and our world, though, and that is investing in space technology. So much of what we fight over is resources. We have arguments over who ought to be making steel, over rare resources such as rare earths and precious metals, over hydrocarbons and oil and natural gas. But looking beyond this rock we live on, towards the vastness of our solar system, makes the resources we've been fighting over down here look like table scraps. The asteroid belt contains more metal than the human race has mined in its existence by orders of magnitude. In terms of hydrocarbons, oil and gas, Saturn's sixth moon, Titan, is basically made of the stuff. There are lakes of liquid natural gas on its surface. As far as energy is concerned, hydrocarbons, oil, gas, are unnecessary. Solar energy is far more effective up there because there's no atmosphere that blocks some of the sun's rays, and there's no day and night cycle. There are these places in the space above us called Lagrange points, eddies in gravity where the gravitational pull of the Earth and sun interact and cancel each other out. If we were to park solar collectors there, then that solar collection would never be interrupted. We already have solar furnaces here on Earth that use parabolic mirrors to create temperatures as high as 3,000 degrees Celsius or more, just using the rays of the sun. But smelting and other industrial work has always been very dirty. There are carbon emissions, there are dangerous chemicals and byproducts that get released. There's char, there's slag. Solar furnaces outside of our atmosphere can not only be larger and more powerful than the solar furnaces here on Earth, but by definition can't pollute our atmosphere because there's no atmosphere to pollute. There's no emissions. A release of radioactive material or harmful chemicals doesn't matter so much up there because there's no life up there for it to harm. And it's far enough away that it's not going to come falling back towards us. And even if it did, it would just burn up in the atmosphere. Making space exploration and the industrialization of space a major industry means a massive amount of jobs. It means transitioning industries that harm our environment to places where they can do no harm. That's the economic argument for space, but there's another better argument to be made. If the human race is to survive, we need to branch out beyond our own planet. There are debates right now about whether our planet is overpopulated. And I don't want to get into that because I think we will have to deal with overpopulation eventually. I don't think we're overpopulated now. But one of the things that can be a great pressure release valve is to provide some kind of frontier for humans to go to. If we start growing now, we can guarantee that moving out to the frontier is a matter of choice, not necessity. I think about all those who were forced to leave Europe or dragged here from Africa or forcibly transported from Ireland and Scotland. And I would like to avoid that happening when it comes to questions of the human species and Earth. But all of that is far, far future thinking. My argument, though, is if we start working towards colonization now, we can guarantee that that sort of thing never happens. But in the immediate present, there's a reason why we should put humans on Mars just as soon as it is possible. And that's because Mars is where the discoveries are. We've now proven that there's liquid water on some parts of Mars. So going to Mars and looking at questions on whether life has developed there can answer a lot of our theories on the origin and variety of life. Is it based on DNA? Does it look like our life? Is it there at all? Could it be? Are the things that we've studied on Earth universal, or do they just apply to Earth? The only way to answer these questions is to put human beings on the Martian surface to do that necessary scientific work. And I've laid out that economic argument, but I personally find this scientific argument to be far more compelling. We won't know what's out there to be found, what new technologies we'll create, what new things there are for us to learn until we actually go out and find them. The benefits for that are literally immeasurable, in that because we don't know what we'll learn, we can't measure what the benefits might be. I see everything I've talked about in this segment to be inherently cohesive. The technologies we should be developing to fight climate change, to prevent flooding, to end droughts and reverse desertification, to take cropland back in California, and to preserve the Earth in so much as that is even possible, are the same technologies that we will require in order to colonize and terraform Mars. Rather than wallowing in hopelessness and seeing current crises we're dealing with as the potential end of everything, we need to be engineering and thinking our way out of these challenges. They aren't the end unless we allow them to be. And if we look at these problems as obstacles to be overcome, they become the next step in our evolution as a species. We already know that our monetary resources are functionally limitless. Our industrial resources can become functionally limitless too. Within the reach of spacecraft, we already have the technology to build. The asteroids contain untold quantities of metal. There's free energy being produced by our sun, and in space, there's no day and night to diminish the effectiveness of those solar collectors. Making use of the technologies we've got to create to save ourselves, and transitioning our dirtier industrial operations to a place where atmospheric emissions are impossible. Building mass infrastructure, feeding the world, making food riots and warfare and starvation and disease things of the past everywhere, fighting back climate change. All of this is part of an interconnected future that sees us growing our home from this planet into space. As our listeners already know, we can afford all of this. We just have to make the decision to do it. That's it for Hopping Mad today. Catch us next week.